Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 2nd of October. Today, the Serious Fraud Office plans to charge the British arms company BAE over claims it paid millions in bribes to win lucrative contracts.
BAE is alleged to have gone around the world bribing foreign officials and politicians in order to get arms sales. It's as simple as that.
How America's powerful healthcare lobby is blocking Barack Obama's reforms.
It's spent a total of $380 million this year alone.
And the legendary newspaper editor Harold Evans talks to us.
That may be I'm old-fashioned romantic. I do myself believe there is a certain glow to the printed page, a certain authority to it.
Well, since it's Friday, with me in the pod are two guests who will be commenting on a range of stories in the news this week. Editor of Guardian America, Michael Tomasky. You're usually based in Washington, Michael, but you've been at the Labour conference this week.
I went for 2 days and then came here to London for 2 days, yes.
But you're not going to the Tories?
I'm skipping the Tories.
Oh, what a shame. And Jane Martinson, media editor of The Guardian. Big media story this week, of course, Jane, is one of The Guardian's so-called rivals switching allegiance to the Conservatives.
Yeah, it was obviously the Sun what won it. So
maybe it'll be The Guardian what wins it next time. Who knows? Anyway, before we hear from our panellists, let's hear from David Lee, our investigations editor. He's going to tell us about the Serious Fraud Office, which plans to prosecute BAE Systems, the British arms giant. The SFO claims the company paid millions to win lucrative contracts.
BAE is alleged to have gone around the world bribing foreign officials and politicians in order to get arms sales. It's as simple as that. However, the task of prosecuting them isn't as simple as that. It's turned out to be a very long and involved investigation that has gone on for 6 years now.
What do we know about the Serious Fraud Office's investigation?
They started in 2004. They have been all over the world themselves, serving orders on people, trying to get cooperation from foreign police authorities, not always easy, foreign regimes, not always cooperative. They've been looking at deals done in Tanzania, in Romania, in the Czech Republic, and in South Africa in particular.
So the Serious Fraud Office has now said it wants to prosecute BAE. What happens now?
This story isn't over yet. They've issued a very strange statement, actually, saying that they intend to prosecute BAE and they're going to ask the Attorney General for formal permission to prosecute BAE when they get round to it. And what they're actually saying is they haven't yet put a date on when they're going to submit the papers to the Attorney General in order to ask for her consent.
And in 2006, the Serious Fraud Office was forced to drop investigations into BAE, its biggest arms deal, into Britain's biggest arms deal involving BAE in Saudi Arabia. That investigation was dropped under pressure from the government. Will this one follow the same fate?
Yes, this is the second attempt by the SFO to bring BAE, as they see it, to justice of some kind. They were headed off by the politicians last time round. You know, Tony Blair was then Prime Minister. Personally forced the SFO to drop their investigation into the Saudi royal family because he said it was upsetting them. This time, we haven't yet got to that point. If we do get to the point when the attorney actually has a set of papers in front of her and has got to decide, am I going to rubber stamp these charges? I would expect BAE will be putting their formidable lobbying machine into operation. They'll be talking about the threat of lost jobs in key northern constituencies. That's generally one of the lines they use.
And which will be pretty persuasive, at least a persuasive argument as far as the government is concerned. Does the Serious Fraud Office really want a prosecution, really want a court battle with this huge company?
To call for prosecution in this way is actually a bit of a signal of failure for the SFO. What they really wanted was an agreed deal, a sort of American-style plea bargain under which there wouldn't have to be a trial with all its risks and uncertainties. And the company would put up its hands, they'd say, we did wrong, it was all in the past, here's a big cash penalty to show we care and we've cleaned up our act, we're going to do everything differently. And then everybody would shake hands and move forward.
But because this is a crucial moment for the Serious Fraud Office, really, isn't it?
Well, they put their credibility on the line once again with this. If BAE hang tough and just refuse to cooperate and challenge them to prosecute, then they're going to have to go and do it, because they've now made it so publicly obvious that this is the route they've threatened, that you know, they would be completely humiliated if they drew back. And then there would have to be an actual prosecution. And that could go on for months or years. It could end very badly. It could cost the taxpayer millions of pounds. Who knows what would happen?
And meanwhile, in the States, there's another investigation into BAE, this time by the US Justice Department.
Yeah, they are investigating BAE for the sort of Saudi bribery allegations which the British government managed to prevent the SFO investigating here. So they picked up the Saudi baton, if you like, but they don't seem to have got anywhere yet either.
David Lee, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/BAE. Michael Tomasky, is there much interest in the United States in this investigation?
It's not a great amount, but it is gathering a little bit. And as it works its way through the U.S. Department of Justice, which I gather is looking at American aspects of this, I think interest will grow. And I think it'll be a good, in addition to the media interest, it'll be a good, interesting test for the new Attorney General, who's got a lot of things on his plate. And this can be now added to them as a big deal.
Jane Martinson, media editor of The Guardian. This story about BAE has been investigated by The Guardian over a number of years. The Guardian revealed its network of secret offshore slush funds. What is the state of investigative journalism, do you think, in Britain? It's quite an expensive thing for newspapers and media organisations to invest in, isn't it?
It's hugely expensive, and it's also something that takes a long time, obviously. So, you know, you can have a team of reporters working on something that doesn't really come out with something, or a team of reporters that come up with something fantastic, but it takes them 6 months to do so. Because of the pressures on news organisations that we've talked about before, you know, declining ad market and structural decline because of the web and people getting news for free, it's something that news groups are increasingly finding, you know, it's tough to try and pay for it. So of all the things that could be cut, it's often the first to go, that and very expensive foreign reporting.
In America, I wouldn't quite call it a trend yet, but people are experimenting with the idea of making investigative units part of a nonprofit arm of the business. And that makes a lot of things easier. The deductions for the people who make the contributions to support a nonprofit make them more likely to keep giving that support. The difficulty is, from a political perspective, that a nonprofit, under American law, a nonprofit investigation has to be very strictly nonpartisan. So, you know, it has to go after both sides equally. Mm-hmm. It has to try not to be political in any capital P kind of way. So there are rules for it. But financially, it's very advantageous. And I think we're going to see more and more of it in the States, nonprofit investigative journalism.
Well, one crusading editor who's very much associated with investigative journalism is Harold Evans. His Sunday Times investigated Kim Philby and the extent of his espionage for the Soviet Union and the thalidomide scandal. Well, he came into The Guardian yesterday and spoke to Matt Wells for our Media Talk podcast.
Even though I love the web, I'm on it all the time, a lot, and my wife has the Daily Beast
Tina Brown.
Website. I love this morning, as I do every morning in New York, opening the newspaper and reading it. That may be, I'm old-fashioned romantic. I do myself believe there is a certain glow to the printed page, a certain authority to it.
Harry, there's been a lot of talk this week about the Sun's decision to swap its support from Labour to the Tories. What did you make of the decision, and perhaps more interestingly, about the reaction to the decision?
Well, just forget the owner of the paper for a minute. It's, you know, The Guardian may decide to go for the National Front or whatever it may be. It'll always cause a sensation. And that shows you, suggests you, that what I'm saying to you is correct. The newspaper still has an authority and a ripple effect because it's expected.
But the Labour Party had sort of nailed its colours to the Murdoch mast, hadn't they?
Well, that, you know, in the past, when Tony Blair came in, I thought, and I said at the time, that they felt that he had an obligation to the Sun was a big mistake.
You know, you're now based in the United States, in New York. Journalism and newspapers in America are in free fall, in crisis. What's your perspective from there? I mean, even the great New York Times is in trouble.
Yeah, they are. I think they'll come through it. Much more concerned than the New York Times, which is such an institution. I don't think it will or can be allowed to be crippled or vanish. Much more dangerous is than the provincial papers and the Chicago and Los Angeles and the state papers, where new ownership, very often without any sympathy or understanding of journalism, the first thing they do is cut the editorial.
Is it conceivable? It is conceivable, isn't it, that the New York Times might go under?
No. I think it's unthinkable. For instance, there are many, if the worst came to the worst, which I don't believe it will, if the worst came to the worst, they're now doing things digitally too, and they've got a pretty good website, the New York Times. If the worst came to the worst, I think that you would find, given the impetus of public philanthropy in the United States, which is much more philanthropic than Britain, Americans as a people and with their institutions are three or four times as philanthropic as I think somebody would come along. In fact, I know people who would like to buy the Times and make it a public institution.
But it comes to something when it requires charity to fund the greatest newspaper in the world.
Charity is the wrong word. It's public interest. Charity sounds like dropping a coin in a beggar's cup. I think we have to be very careful here, building a total atmosphere of defeatism about print and newspapers.
Harold Evans and his autobiography, My Paper Chase, is published by Little Brown. Michael Tomasi, one of the things that Harold Evans was talking about to us was the trust that American journalism lost to a certain extent during the Iraq War. I mean, what's your opinion of how the American media has regained some of that trust since then?
I'm not sure that it has. I mean, it may regain some by default as time goes on and people tend to start to forget things. But, the media in America is just, as they say, as the joke goes, one rung above child molesters. It's not, and really, I think our political media really has hit a serious wall, not just recently, but over the last few years. The reporting on the Lewinsky scandal was largely terrible. The reporting on the 2000 election was largely pretty bad. The reporting in the run-up to the Iraq War was largely indefensible. So these are systemic institutional problems that aren't just episodic.
Jane, what's your opinion of that?
Well, Harry Evans was saying something interesting about that today, and saying that since the Iraq War, because it was so sort of traumatic for organisations like the New York Times, there has been an attempt to try to hold power to account, whether that's working or not. And I was interested in what you said about these philanthropic, if you like, sort of ventures to try to do sort of investigations. Because typically, in the States, there's been this history of incredibly balanced, impartial reporting, which has actually sometimes acted as a bar to something's wrong here and we're going to go find out what it is. And I don't know if these sort of philanthropically funded, typically by wealthy individuals or families, is sort of going to fill that gap. I mean, there's a big cultural shift here. And Harry Evans sort of went some way to say he felt that the trauma, if you like, of the Iraq War had maybe done something to actually push the way through, to actually bring about some sort of cultural change. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, do you agree with that?
I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I fear that if that kind of situation arises again in the United States, the major media will do exactly the same thing. Mm. There's so much. When a president wants to have a war, so much machinery kicks in to support that point of view in the foreign policy establishment, in the high precincts of power, and it just becomes very difficult for people who travel in that rarefied atmosphere to buck it. And that includes the people who own and published newspapers. And so I'm less sanguine about it.
What was your take, Michael, on... You were in Brighton this week when The Sun revealed that it was going to be supporting the Conservatives in the next election and not Labour. What was your impression of that?
Yeah, I'm obviously no expert on British domestic politics, but, it's something of a blow to Labour, but I gather not that surprising to a lot of people. And I'm not sure that... people talk about 97, but I also think of, was it 92, when wasn't it The Sun that said that we're the last one who leaves Britain?
Mm. The Sun what won it afterwards,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, right. Well, I don't think they can do that to Brown because...
he's lost it already.
Yeah, right. Brown is the prime minister, whereas, what they were able to do to Labour that time was to frighten people into thinking that if Labour got in, the sky would fall in. But they can't quite do that the same way, I don't think.
I think Mike's absolutely right. The surprising thing in a way is how surprised we've all been. The Sun has never backed, it doesn't back losers, and it sort of goes the way that its readers are going. The Sun are never going to back Labour for the next election. The surprise, I suppose, is the timing. They chose... the sort of upper echelons of News International have been quite close, not the Murdoch family, but Rebecca Brooks, as she now is, Rebecca Wade, when she edited The Sun. Is a great friend of Sarah Brown's, the wife of Gordon. And so the sort of manner in which it happened, which was, to deliver maximum impact after he'd delivered a speech as if it were in any way a judgment on his speech, when it was pretty obvious from the fact that they had, they already had the blue vans saying, "We're feeling blue" at The Sun. That was absolutely choreographed.
Now, we're going to hear from Michael Tomasky's colleague in Washington now, Chris McGreal, who's got a story about how the American healthcare industry has reacted to President Obama's attempts to introduce reforms.
Principally by throwing huge amounts of money at the problem. It's spent a total of $380 million this year alone in advertising, in donations, political donations to members of Congress, particularly members of key committees that are deciding on this legislation. And it's deployed hordes of lobbyists onto Capitol Hill to try and push the industry case. There's actually 6 registered healthcare lobbyists for every member of Congress on Capitol Hill. And their cases, depending on which particular industry we're talking about, when we're talking about the insurance companies, they're attempting to kill off any public health insurance option, which they seem to have done pretty successfully. And the pharmaceutical companies wanted to make sure that there was nothing that would enable the government to curb the price of drugs, which they also seem to have done pretty successfully.
It seems a pretty stark example of political contributions buying influence with politicians.
Well, yes, and I don't think the lobbyists would deny that that's a big part of the way politics works on Capitol Hill, not just with the health industry. Certainly the chairman of the Finance Committee in the Senate, which is deciding this key piece of legislation, Max Baucus, has taken $1.5 million for his political fund from the health industry. That's the single largest donation of the lot. He denies that it has any influence on him, but talk to the lobbyists and they say, well, of course, we give the money understanding that there will be, if nothing else, access and will be given a good hearing. And they understand when they take the money what's expected of them.
And the bill that comes out on the other end, the laws that will finally reach the statute, but what will they look like?
Well, that's still in flux at the moment, but I think it's pretty clear, particularly from a couple of votes in the Senate this week, that the public health option now is really fighting for its life. The insurance companies do seem to have the upper hand. The White House is retreating on it. And there are a number of reasons for that. There's been a genuinely popular reaction against it in many quarters in this country at these town hall meetings we've seen. But as it was described by a former member of Clinton's cabinet, the fear of the combination of industry money backing that kind of on-the-ground objection has led the White House to retreat on this issue.
Chris McGreal in Washington. Well, Michael Tomasky, will the lobbyists succeed in wrecking Obama's plans?
I think that a bill will probably be passed. I've thought all along that, you know, whatever the eruptions and perturbations and controversies, they have the votes. And I think at the end of the day, those votes will hold together. How strong the bill will be, it's hard to say. Obviously, the lobbies, I read one figure over the summer, $1.4 million a day is spent in Washington by the healthcare industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and so forth a day. I mean, just figure out how much that is an hour. It's insane. So they're spending a lot of money trying to influence the shape of the legislation. They will benefit from the legislation, particularly the insurance companies, the private insurance companies, because the legislation will call on more people to be insured. That's a good thing. That's a public good. More people should have health insurance coverage in America, but somebody will profit from that, and that'll be the insurance companies. So they always get their piece.
The really interesting thing from a sort of UK perspective is how vicious the reporting has been about the NHS.
It's not the NHS that we recognise at all.
Well, this is not, you know, this isn't being spread by people who are interested in giving anything that might remotely be called an accurate presentation of the NHS, right? This is being spread by people who want Barack Obama to suffer a humiliating political defeat. So they're just going to come over here and they're going to find whatever horror story, however unrepresentative it might be, and say, you know, this is what happens to everybody in England. You know, you have to wait 8 months to get sprained ankle, you know, or whatever it is. So it's just about politics. It's not about, you know, trying to make any truthful representation.
Well, Barack Obama's in Copenhagen for today's announcement by the International Olympics Committee about who will host the 2016 Games. Oprah Winfrey's also there, and the Guardian sports correspondent, Owen Gibson.
Well, for all that IOC President Jack Rogge has said that he hopes the heads of state and royalty and the big sporting names don't make a difference to the final outcome, there's no doubt that there's only one name on everyone's lips here, and it's that of Barack Obama. So I think that his arrival today can't help but fail to make an appreciable difference to the outcome.
And what the other countries, Rio, Tokyo, Madrid, they've all brought some big hitters as well.
They've all brought their big names. The President of Brazil is here, King Juan Carlos of Spain, the new Japanese Prime Minister flew in overnight. So, yes, they've all brought their big names out, as well as by far the glitziest guest list for one of these events in history. But they've all been slightly outshone by the decision of the President to swoop in.
How does the voting work?
Well, it's at once quite simple and quite complicated. You just need a simple majority in any one round to win, but the lowest score in each round is knocked out. But the complication and the strategy comes in as those that are knocked out transfer their votes to a new city. So it's always a sort of constantly moving feast to try and work out who's in the lead at any given point, and very 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 fine margins can tip the balance. It's commonly accepted that if Madrid had made it down to the final two in 2005, for example, then London would have lost out. So it was only a couple of votes that it came down to then, and people here are expecting today's vote to be even closer.
Owen Gibson in Copenhagen. Michael Tomasky, this is important to the Obamas, isn't it? I mean, they count Chicago as their home.
Yeah, it's their hometown together. And they've obviously put a lot of personal prestige on the line here. I'm generally speaking a supporter of the president, so I think he's doing a good job. But I think Olympics games are kind of boondoggles, as you folks may well learn here in 2012.
Sorry, boondoggles? What's that?
Oh, you don't have...
No. Yeah. Jane, do you know what that is? No.
White elephant, you know, overly costly, slightly shady.
Well, a lot of people do think that, don't they, Jane?
Yeah. I mean, the view that that's the case is definitely growing. You know, the costs, every time any story, the costs are escalating. You know, even the sort of individual decisions about where events are going to be held are becoming increasingly controversial. I mean, you know, I live in Greenwich, which is where the equestrian events are going to be held. When the announcement was made, people were literally cheering in the streets. Now there are mass demonstrations about how they're going to rip up the trees and spoil the environment and, you know, National Heritage Site in order to put the games in place. So, I mean, and we're still, you know, 2 years away.
Yeah, I only hope if Chicago gets these games that they come up with a better logo than London did.
Michael Tomasky, Jane Martinson, many thanks. Our producer today was Harriet Grant. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.